So welcome to the second in our series of sutta classes for this year, and this week we're going to be starting the reading from Bhikkhu Bodhi's in the Buddha's words, and the first sutta on aging and death. So Bhikkhu Bodhi starts out aptly enough with a chapter on the human condition, and so that's what we'll have a bit of a look at this week and see what the Buddha had to say about the human condition. We've already got some comments about the human condition there, but as we go through these suttas, I won't necessarily read out every sutta in the chapter, but I'll read out some of the suttas in each chapter, and at the same time I'll show the Pali on the screen, and also the correspondences in Chinese, and if we have a translation, then we can do that as well. Okay, so this one starts out: human condition, old age, illness and death, typically cheery subject for Buddhists to lighten up the morning with. So Sanyutta Nikaya 3.3. Now, I think it's useful, just before we start, remember we're talking about, on the first week, we're talking about the text as a whole, like a kind of picture of the Buddhist scriptures as a whole. Now this is a contents list of the Buddhist scriptures, okay, in Pali, and here we've had the Vinaya, the different chapters of the Vinaya, Sutta Vibhanga, and then the two Khandakas here, Mahavagga and Chulavagga, and then here the suttas: Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Sanyutta Nikaya, Anguttara Nikaya, and the Kudika Nikaya. So the five sections of the suttas. So now we're reading from the Sanyutta Nikaya, the first chapter, the Saggatavagga. Right. So it's just useful to get an idea, a picture in your mind, get familiar with when we're reading this. Reading suttas and texts, where do they come from? Because I constantly find people saying to me, "Oh, it says X, Y, Z in the suttas," or something like that, and I immediately think, "Well, where does it actually come from?" Rather than just quoting the suttas as such, but where does it come from? Where does that fit into the scheme of things? So here we're looking at the Saggatavagga of the Sanyutta Nikaya, and here's the Pali. Okay, so this particular sutta in the Sanyutta Nikaya and has three corresponding suttas. This one in the Sanyutta Nikaya, Sanyukta Agama, from the Sarvastivadins, second Sanyukta Agama, and also Nyakottara Agama. So we won't do a comparative study of these, but just to show you where the Chinese versions of this. So here's the Chinese version. Sister Sarah, do you speak Chinese?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay, very good. You're in trouble. It's a bit hard to Well, why don't we lost that there. Okay, so we can, as we read down there, you can, Shirley and Sister Sarah can keep an eye on the Chinese. Let us know if there's any interesting little points of difference or divergence from the past. So, Asavati, King Pasenadi of Kosala, said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, is anyone who is born free from aging and death? Great King, no one who is born is free from aging and death. Even those influential Khatiyas, rich with great wealth and property, with abundant gold and silver, abundant treasures and commodities, abundant wealth and grain, because they've been born, are not free from aging and death. even those influential Brahmins, householders who are rich and with abundant wealth and grain, because they've been born, they're not free from aging and death. Even those monks who are arahants, whose taints are destroyed, who've lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached their own goal, utterly destroyed the fetters of existence, and are completely liberated through final knowledge. Even for them, this body is subject to breaking up, subject to being laid down. And then finishing off with the verse, the beautiful chariots of kings wear out, this body too undergoes decay, but the Dhamma of the good does not decay, so the good proclaim along with the good. Okay, so it looks like there's more verses there in the Chinese than there are in the Pali, which is not unusual. So this particular little sutta, King Pasenadi, of course, being one of the great kings at the time of the Buddha, and kind of the paradigmatic worldling, if you like, always sort of, you know, he had a kind of great attachment for the Buddha and affection for him and his teaching, but was a bit slow on the uptake sometimes, and quite overcome with a lot of worldly desires and so on. So he was the one that the Buddha gave the weight loss diet to, for once, and he had to get scolded by his wife on a number of occasions because of his lack of insight into Dhamma. So this particular message, you know, in a sense seems obvious to us, but coming from an ancient perspective is not as obvious as it might seem. A similar theme was already broached by Yajna Valkya talking to his wife Maitreyi, when he told her the same thing, that all the wealth and so on in the world is not going to protect you from death. But that's a kind of an insight. Like if we look back at earlier civilizations, at the Egyptians, for example, you know, they clearly thought that in some sense wealth did buy you freedom from death. Yeah, and that by building the pyramids, by preserving your body, by supplying you with abundant things to carry you across the river of death, that you would actually literally be supplied with those things in the afterlife. Not 100% unlike what the Chinese still do today. Yeah, and you get all the paper toys and the paper mobile phones and the paper money, and you burn it when people die. And so when they go to heaven, then they can have their own mobile. You think you'd want a break from using your mobile phone in heaven. I don't know where the Vodafone actually reaches there, but anyway, from the claims that Telstra make, they probably say that they'd be able to reach there. But it's quite clear, you know. So from a lot of people, you know, over a long period of time, literally did believe that the resources, the physical material things that you had in this life, would be physically useful to it for you after death. And so this message of the Buddha, not unique to the Buddha, but very characteristic to counteract that idea. And even the spiritual attainment is not about getting beyond the kind of physical death. And that's also something which is not at all obvious, in the sense that even today we find a lot of effort goes into the quest for living forever and longevity, yeah? And people sort of putting more and more money into, you know, making yourself live for as long as you can, and a sort of obsession with sort of prolonging the last few days or weeks of your life in the medical profession, the whole cosmetics industry and cosmetic surgery. But even within spiritual circles, where so much effort goes into health foods and all of these kinds of things to help you to live for longer. And so this is why in Buddhism we don't have to feel guilty about not eating health foods. It's actually a joke. One of the jokes that Ajahn Brahm tells a story at his funerals about the man. I shouldn't tell, but anyway, man and wife died. It's a bit of a long joke. They both die very at the same time, and they go to heaven, and they're being taken by the angel around the heavenly palace, and the angel takes them and says, "Okay, here's your lovely new house." And the husband says, "My goodness, what a wonderful mansion! But I could never afford that." And the angel says, "No. This is heaven. You don't have to pay for anything. But what about the council rates? There's no council rates. You're in heaven." And the man, when he hears this, he gives his wife a really foul look. And then they got shown to upstairs, and he said, "Here's the CD collection. Here's the stereo. Here's the latest thing. You know, all 18 of Beethoven's symphonies." He said, "Hang on, he's only wrote 9 symphonies. No, he hasn't been wasting his time up here." And when he heard this, he gave his wife another foul look. And then he said, "And over the road, you've got your own private 18-hole golf course." Gave his wife another foul look. And then he said, "You know, look in the garage." He said, "Look at beautiful cars. You've got a Ferrari. You've got a Bugatti, a Rolls Royce. You've got a Toyota Land Cruiser. You've got Then he said, "But I couldn't possibly pay for the registration and insurance on all these cars." He said, the angel said, "Don't worry, you don't have to pay, this is heaven, there's no petrol, you don't have to pay anything for the petrol." And gave his wife an even worse look. And then the angel said, "Okay, now, I hope you enjoy yourself, I'll be off, and if you need anything, just give me a call straight away, and I'll come and fix it for you, no problem." So he goes off, and then the wife says to the husband, but... "My darling, we've got such a wonderful place here and you've been giving me all these awful looks. Why have you been treating me so badly?" And he said, "Well, if it wasn't for all the health food you've been giving me, we could have been here years ago." So in Buddhism, we're not too concerned about those things. But now an interesting little point about this sutta is that when the death of the arahants is described, it doesn't use the same word for death. It doesn't use the word marana for death. It just says the breaking up of the body and the laying down of the carcass, which is quite interesting. That there's no, and that's quite consistently through the suttas, that it doesn't actually say that the arahant dies as such. It says that they lay down the body.
Yeah, sure. Only your body there, so not your mind.
Mm.
So recently I met one monk in Sri Lanka who claimed himself an arahant.
Mm.
And he said all the Buddha and arahant are here, they are amata, they never die.
They never die.
So if we develop our consciousness to amata to some certain extent, we can communicate with them. They are all young.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting because when we are trying to find your master, when we are trying to try something like this.
Yeah, well, that was very controversial. Yeah, the Ajahn, they claimed that he could communicate with the Buddhas and the Arahants in the past, and certainly not the normal Theravadan teaching. It's a very controversial claim. What he exactly meant by that?
Mm. You know, the monk in Sri Lanka at the moment, he said we got all the things wrong because of commentary. Actually, it is because commentary and Theravada at the moment make it become the nihilist. Actually, the Buddha never take nihilism like this.
Mm.
So, the arahant attain your amata, it means your mind never dies. So,
There's plenty of places in the suttas where it talks about the cessation of the mind as well.
Yes.
It doesn't talk just about the ending of the body. In this particular case, it's talking about like the physical laying down of the body. But there's plenty of cases where it talks about the mind coming to an end as well, when the arahant passes away and the Buddha passes away. All the 5 khandhas come to an end, not just the physical khandhas. That's not a commentarial innovation. Mm.
Sorry? What is the decay? Why is
that
different from that one?
Yeah, it's never explained or made explicit why that difference in phraseology is there.
Mm-hmm.
My feeling is that the implication is that when it's talking about death, it's always talking about death in terms of a cycle. birth, aging and death. And so they kind of left that cycle. So death is something which is always followed by a further rebirth. So they've just kind of stepped out of that cycle, as it were. But it's interesting. It's just it's a quirky little usage, which it's quite interesting.
Is that common?
This is a standard usage. Yeah, it's a standard usage. Any interesting points in the Chinese text? It's very similar.
For me, the poems are a little bit different. The
poems a bit different, yeah.
Especially the teaching of the mind. But I think the Chinese, it didn't say the teaching of the mind, it just said the teaching of the Dharma.
Okay.
Specifically the mind.
Teaching of the mind, I'm not sure if that's in. The Dhamma of the good, it says here, does not decay. Let me just see what the Pali says there. Pali says, Satancha Dhammo Najaram Upeti. Yeah, it doesn't say the teaching of the mind. No.
In Vietnamese version, I'm sure it's your Dhamma, not your mind.
Yeah.
Mind of the Chitta.
Yeah.
So
your
English version might
be
something wrong.
Yeah, English
the English translation is quite different to the Kabir's one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This one just in sort of when we're looking at the translations on the website, these translations are ones as found on sort of Central, and when we put together sort of Central, we just used whatever translations were available on the web. And so they come from different places, some from Venerable Tanisaro, these particular ones from Sister Uplawana, a Sri Lankan nun, who's done them. And these ones are not terrific translations. So Bhikkhu Bodhi's, if you're reading them and they differ from Bhikkhu Bodhi, then always Bhikkhu Bodhi is more trustworthy. Okay, so let's. Next one, simile of the mountain. I might skip that one and have a look at the next one is Anguttara Nikaya. So notice how I can find all this stuff on Sutta Central. So we've got the references down the bottom here in Bhikkhu Bodhi's edition. It says Anguttara AN 3.35. So I just look on Sutta Central for AN 3.35. Occasionally the numbers don't add up because there's different ways of counting them. So I can't necessarily, but it has the alternative numbers here. So here's the alternative number. This one's the Devadutta. So it's on here. So here's the Pali text. Okay, this is the Devadutta Sutta. These are the Chinese corresponding suttas. Right. So that tells you something, doesn't it? That tells you this was a popular sutta found in the Majjhima Agama of the Sarvastivadins. Three independent sutras, T42, T43 and T86. So these are miscellaneous sutras which are Majjhima Nikaya style suttas, found as independent suttas in the Chinese, in the Taisho Tripitaka, but not included within a Nikaya, but similar style to a Majjhima Sutta. Anguttara Agama, equivalent to the Pali Anguttara Nikaya, also found in the Dirga Agama in Chinese, probably part of a sutta in the Dirga Agama, being the long discourses, and similarly T24, T25 would be similar. Partial correspondences, there'd be a bit of a sutta in there. Taisho 2.12.9, I'm not sure where that is, so that's a slightly unusual one. T741, again slightly unusual, and another partial parallel in the Pali canon in the Majjhima Nikaya. I don't know why they've got this as a full parallel, that should be a partial parallel as well. Okay, So when you see that, that something got so many correspondences, then that is a hint that it's quite a popular sutta in the Buddhist world, for whatever reason. Okay, so there are these celestial messengers, divine messengers. This particular sutta is interesting. Apart from its intrinsic interest, is also one of the sources for the story of the Bodhisattva seeing the four signs when he went forth. There are these three divine messengers. What three? There is a person of bad conduct in body, speech and mind. On the dissolution of the body after death, he is reborn in the plane of misery in a bad destination in a lower world in hell. There the waters of hell seize him by both arms and take him before Yama, the god of death, saying, "This man, your majesty, had no respect for his father and mother, not for ascetics and Brahmins, nor did he honour the elders of the family. May your majesty inflict due punishment upon him." Then monks, Yama questions, the king Yama questions that man, examines him and addresses him. And this is a very important part of the sutta. Yama, samanu yunjanti, samanu ghahati, samanu bhasati. So it's this kind of interrogation process. Concerning the first divine messenger, "Didn't you ever see, my good man, the first divine messenger appearing among humankind?" And he replies, "No, Lord, I did not see him." Then Yama says to him, "But my good man, didn't you ever see a woman or a man 80, 90 or 100 years old, frail, bent like a roof bracket, crooked, leaning on a stick, shakily going along, ailing, youth and vigour gone, with broken teeth, with grey and scanty hair, or bald, wrinkled, with blotched limbs?" The man said, "Well, yes, Lord, I have seen this." And then King Yama said to him, "My good man, didn't it ever occur to you, an intelligent and mature man, I too am subject to old age and cannot escape it. Let me now do noble deeds by body, speech and mind." He replies, "No, Lord, I could not do it. I was negligent." And Yama said, "Through negligence, my good man, you failed to do noble deeds by body, speech and mind. Well, you will be treated as befits your negligence. That evil action of yours was not done by mother or father, brothers, sisters, friends or companions, nor by relatives, devas, ascetics or Brahmins, but you alone have done that evil deed, and you will have to experience the fruit." Okay, so this is a very important statement on karma here.
Yeah.
You do it, you get it, right? Not you do it and somebody else gets it, right? And again, this is something which is part of the revolution, which the kind of ethical revolution which Buddhism brought into the world, was the idea of ownership and responsibility for your acts, and rather than the common doctrine, which they call the doctrine of vicarious atonement. So who knows what vicarious atonement means?
Somebody else can take the
blame. Yeah, you do it and you can blame somebody else and get away with it.
Scapegoat,
yeah. Let's see if I can Google it. Oops. Vicarious atonement. Oops. Right. Vicarious atonement. There is no such thing as vicarious atonement. Well, there's the there's the first thing.
Substitution.
Vicarious atonement. Yeah. So here's some ideas of vicarious atonement. Meaning of vicarious dispensationalists believe that Christ's death alone paid for sin, as opposed to the covenant of theology teaching that his active obedience to the law during his we don't need to get into all the Christology of it. The vicarious atonement, the theory of the atonement, which states that Christ's death was legal, satisfied the legal justice of God. Yeah. So this is This is this idea that there's a sort of certain amount of quantity of evil or sin or pain in the world that needs to be paid for, and if you don't pay for it, somebody else will pay for it. It's a bit like doctrine of vicarious atonement. It's a bit like what's happening to the banks right now. Yeah. So we don't have to if we don't pay our debts, that we don't manage our accounts, the government will come along and pay them for us. Yeah. That's the doctrine of vicarious atonement. So the doctrine of taking responsibility of karma is something quite different. Yeah, I mean, in terms of Buddhist doctrine, there's no doubt that what we're seeing here in this sutta is the mainstream Buddhist teaching is that you're responsible for your acts, other people are not, and that's obviously that's the point that's been put here quite strongly and quite firmly. Whether it's possible to sneak a doctrine of transference of merit in on the side and to render that consistently with this doctrine, I must admit I personally have some fairly major doubts about that. It's certainly not normal that in any religion that the beliefs and practices of people within it are consistent with the kind of actual theoretical doctrine. So we shouldn't expect that it would be. There is this idea that which found perhaps once or twice in the suttas and is used by later explainers as well, to which says that when you share offerings with hungry ghosts, that they can actually be aware that you're doing that. So that's like some kind of consciousness or something which is hanging around in a sense, or in some way is aware of the fact that you're thinking of them, and because they're aware of it, then they can be happy because of that, and so that's the only kind of merit that they can make in that realm. Okay, so there's, in a sense, it's their mudita, their appreciation and gratitude to you because you're thinking of it, and that's why that they can be benefited. It's not actually, you know, in that sense it's sharing a merit in more like the ordinary everyday sense that Jen was talking about before, whereas if you have a good person who's in a good mood, they tend to communicate that with others and then they pick it up. Yeah? So it's not a kind of mysterious transferal of merit, or if you're in a bad mood, then other people tend to pick that up. And so in that way there's a degree of influence, but in other realms apart from the Prayata realm, it doesn't kind of work because they're too disconnected from this realm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And because you still determine how you respond to that, and that's what the point of this sutta as well is. You know, we always have lessons in life. Yeah, I mean, seeing an old person is not something unusual or anything. It's not, but it's how do you actually respond to that? Yeah, and so there's maybe different ways of responding to that. Somebody maybe responds with scorn and laughs at them because they're old or something like that. Somebody else responds maybe with kindness, wants to help. So it's a compassionate response. Somebody else responds by reflecting on the meaning of old age. So it's a reflective response. So that's under our control to a certain degree.
In this, the case of this sutta, the response, the fellow being questioned by Yama is he just had no response.
Yeah, he said I was.
So the demerit is not, it's sort of a demerit of omission rather than he didn't actually do something.
No, because he said as a result of that, that he didn't take the opportunity to do good.
Yeah.
So it doesn't actually.
It's not as if he did something, made positive. I didn't score them or something.
Yeah, no, that's right.
Yeah,
it was.
He didn't take the opportunity, which is seen as being. I think that that's a really part of that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah. Yep.
Can these things happen without mind and consciousness?
And what things happen?
Gains or whatever.
No.
It has mind and consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's sort of basically saying you can't sort of float through life and just look after yourself.
That's right, not care about it, yeah? Not respond to it. So then King Yama said, second divine messenger, Didn't you ever see a woman or a man who was sick and in pain, seriously ill, lying in their own filth, having to be lifted up by some and put to bed by others? Yes, Lord, I have seen this. Good man, didn't it ever occur to you, an intelligent and mature person, that I too am subject to illness and cannot escape it? Let me now do noble deeds by body, speech and mind. Okay. No, Lord, I could not do it. I was negligent. So the word for negligent here is pamada.
Pamada. If you're not being proactive, then you're being negligent.
Yeah.
I think that's
fascinating.
That's an interesting point. It's like, she'll be right, mate. It's not. Or be
yeah.
content with
10 precepts.
Yeah. Be content with the environment for them. I need to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But do they have many cases, like this is very much an individual making effort on an individual level. Do they have any cases where negligence on a kind of more communal or wider level is kind of looked at as kind of, spiritual failing or spiritual apathy?
In like what kind of things?
Well, like those kind of social justice issues or environmental kind of levels, like, you know, on a kind of more engaged sense.
I can't think of any.
Which is quite interesting.
It is, yeah.
Because I can't think of many teachings either that kind of encourage that.
Yeah, no, the ethics is
very much kind of, acceptance rather than, seeing the danger and acting.
Yeah, it's much more the ethics you find in the suttas is much more like a skillful how an individual should respond skillfully to the circumstances that present themselves to them, rather than changing those circumstances. So even in cases where the Buddha recognised that certain circumstances were unjust, like say the caste system, he still didn't have like a sort of a social program for changing those circumstances. I mean, he'd dispute with the Brahmins, but he didn't sort of say, it's your duty, O Katyas, rise up, you have nothing to lose but your change or anything like that. Yeah, so we don't see that kind of thing. Yeah. Okay, and so here the doing good, just to see, keep an eye on the Pali vocabulary here, the doing bad here is pamada, the negligence, and the doing good is a kalyana. Okay, so did you not do kalyana by body, by speech, by mind? Okay, so it's not done by your mother, by your mata, by your father, pita, by your brother, bhata, bhagini, your sister, and not by your friends and relatives and so on, not by devatas, not by samanas and brahmanas. So just as a linguistic point, you can see these words here for the family. Matara, mata, is the mother. Pita, father. Bahata, brother. And it was actually recognizing these specific words and their relation to European languages, and obviously related to mother as mata, pita as father, similar to the idea you have in English of the paternal or something like that, and bhata as brother. And when the English linguists noted the relationship between these words and the European words for family, that's when they first realized that they must be related languages. Okay.
Yeah.
Sister is not. Yeah, that does that. Got lost somewhere. I don't know where the word sister comes from. We're okay. So you alone have done that, and he said the third divine messenger. No, Lord, I did not see him. Didn't you ever see a woman or a man 1, 2, or 3 days dead? blue, bloated and livid, bloated and festering. Uncle Fester. Okay. Festering is here we go. Udhumatakang is bloated. Vinilakang is livid. Vinilakang is a nice word. Nila, you might know from some Sinhala or something, is sort of blue or blue green. It's like aqua blue sometimes. And V has the idea here of kind of dis or distorted or kind of so vinila is like rotten blue or something like that. And vipubhaka, and pubha is the pus. So vipubhaka jata. Jata is literally born, but it means coming out. So like pus, see a rotten pus coming out, yeah, festering.
This is the body.
Yeah, this is the dead body. Sorry?
Couldn't happen.
Not to you. No, of course not.
Sorry.
So we're contesting the suttas on medical grounds. Pus is
white blood cells.
Dead white blood cells.
Response to, you know, to bacterial infection.
So it's a different stuff. The stuff which bubbles is not technically pus. Thank you so much for that. I didn't know that. So that's good.
I don't know. It's rotten stuff. You know.
Just rotten stuff. Yeah, we put the gun. Okay, that's good. Well, we'll write to the redactors of the Pali Canon and get them to change that then. Okay, so you have done that evil deed and you will feel the results of it. Now, interestingly enough, Bhikkhu Bodhi's abridged this one here and he doesn't go on to the end of it, which is more the fun part. So, and it's just his negligence. And he says he didn't do good by means of body, speech and mind, so the implication is he was doing bad by body, speech and mind.
But what's the good when you see that? What's the good that you can do by...
Well, to reflect that you yourself are... Yeah. So didn't you...
No time to waste.
And so all of these things, did it not occur to you, I too have not gone beyond death, therefore I should do good by body, speech and mind. Yeah. So it's always aham pi kom hi. Marana dhammo, maranang anatito. It's the same word that's used in the Satipatthana Sutra in the contemplation of the corpse. So it's I also am of that same nature, the nature to die. Yeah. So and then this word here, handa is like an imperative particle. It means this is what I should do. You know, let me go and do good by body, speech and mind. Yeah. So it's a kind of imperative feel to it. I was negligent. It was done by you, and you will experience results in return. Now, the king of the underworld, Yama, having cross-questioned, asked for reasons, and conversed with him about the celestial messenger, becomes silent. Donhi bhavena, donhi ahosi. There we go. Donhi hoti, becomes silent. Okay. So it's very interesting to notice this, the role of Yama, the king of the dead, he's not a judge and he's not a punisher. His job is to question. Right? He's like the kind of the George Negus of the firmament. His job is to, or the, I don't know who they have, the Andrew Denton or something like that. He sits up there and he's the one who asks you. Then when he finishes, he falls silent. Yeah, so he's inviting a process of reflection, but not actually a punishment. Then the waters of hell. Now, who are these waters of hell? The suttas don't go into it at all, but interestingly enough, Vasubandhu, in his treatise where he tried to establish the Yogacara doctrine, made a very interesting argument where he said he tried to argue for the unreality of the world, that the world is like a dream or an image or a mirage. And his argument was something along the lines of, just as the waters of hell are a mirage and yet you still feel the pain, so too the world in general is a mirage or an image and yet you still feel the suffering from it. And so he was using the idea that he assumed that everybody already believed that the waters of hell were just a projection of your imagination. That he wasn't trying to argue that that was the case. He was taking that was the premise of his argument, that he was assuming, oh yeah, of course we all know that the waters of hell are a figment of your imagination, but it still hurts, right? And in the same way, the world is the same. That's the argument used by Vasubandhu about the 4th century. Okay, so waters of hell give him the fivefold punishment. They fix a burning iron peg to each of his hands and two others to each of his feet and another piercing his chest. On account of it, he feels sharp, unpleasant feelings.
This wasn't genuine.
Yeah, no, Bhikkhu Bodhi left this bit out. Maybe he thought it wasn't suitable for American consumption or something. Yeah. Then on account of that he feels sharp, rough, unpleasant feelings, but does not die until the results of that even action is exhausted. Okay? Then they cut him with a knife, he feels sharp, unpleasant feelings. They hang him head downwards and work on him with a hatchet. They tie him to a cart and make him run to and fro on ground that's ablaze with fire. They make him climb up and down a lofty rock which is blazing with fire. Then they take him by the feet and throw him into a boiling molten pot. He gets boiled in its foam. While getting boiled, he sometimes dives into it and comes out of it and swims across of it, on account of which he feels sharp, rough, unpleasant feelings, but he does not die until the results of that evil action gets exhausted. And then they put him in the great hell. Right? That's just the preliminaries. That's just warming up, right? So to speak. Then they put him in the great hell. He has four doors and the four cornered squares divided and subdivided all round. There's an iron wall and an iron roof on top. Its iron floor is burning all the time. It's spread for 700 miles and stand there all the time. Yeah. So if you want more details on the hells and things in the Devadutta Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, it goes into quite a lot more. Yeah, but it should be a partial parallel. Okay. So because at one time it occurred to the king of the underworld, Yama, the god of the underworld, Yama the Raja, those who do evil actions in the world are subject to these various punishments. Oh, I should gain humanity, become a human, that I should be born as a human at a time when the Buddha is in the world, and that I should have a chance to associate with him and hear the teaching. I should know that teaching. Okay? And so, what was I saying? So the Buddha here is claiming that this is something that, or the text is claiming that it's something that he's heard himself. Okay. Okay, and some verses summarizing at the end as well. So this is quite a very strong sutta, very powerful one. Not one that you kind of forget in a hurry.
Who was he speaking to?
Yeah, it's just general. It's not a particular. Could be all these bogans from Campbelltown are there or something like that, and he needs to sort of give them a Wednesday Dhamma.
People who are a bit older,
right.
Don't need as much
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It says students, Manava. Manava is a Brahmin student. Yeah. So, I mean, the fact that it is a bit specific at the end there does suggest that there maybe was a specific audience in mind which may have been lost. We could have a look through the Chinese suttas. Sometimes there might be a more narrative context preserved there. All right. Okay. Okay, so let's have a look at another sutta. This one is about okay, we'll have a look at this one. It's on the called by Bhikkhu Bodhi, the dart of painful feeling. Yeah, this is another cheerful one. And Sanghita Nikaya 33.6. So it goes here to 36. The Vedana Sanyuta and Salla. So here the Pali, here the correspondences, and here we have the various translations.
Sorry.
Oh, go away. The dart. Okay. So this one, let's have a look at the corresponding suttas. So just in this case, just one corresponding sutta, and here in the Vedana Samyukta of the Chinese Samyukta Agama. And again, we won't do a detailed comparative study, but just so you can see, here's the Chinese version of that. So again, just I'm sure you all know, I'm going to keep on hammering this again and again, but the reason why I keep on insisting on this, even if we can't read the Chinese in detail, we don't have the chance to do it just now, but so that we all know, we all understand that these suttas don't belong somehow to the Pali canon, that we just read them in the Pali because that's the most convenient form that we have them, and that there are Chinese versions which generally speaking are much the same as the Pali. And it's always good very important to bear that in mind, that we don't forget that these things are actually Buddhist suttas. They're not the kind of property of the Pali school in any way.
From early Buddhist literature rather than from a particular school.
Yeah. Okay, so we have the Pali and the English. Okay. Monks, when the uninstructed worldling experiences a painful feeling, he sorrows, grieves, and laments. Okay, this one here is a bit more complete. Vicar Bodhisattva's a bit edited, I'll read the complete one. An untaught worldling amongst experiences pleasant feelings, he experiences painful feelings, and experiences neutral feelings. A well-taught noble disciple likewise experiences pleasant, painful, and neutral feelings. Now, what's the distinction, the diversity, the difference between a well-taught noble disciple and an untaught worldling? All right. So, here's the dilemma. When you get enlightened, you experience painful, pleasant, and neutral feelings, just like everybody else. So what's the point? If you're just going to be experiencing the same three feelings, why do you keep practicing? What's the difference? So the world here they've translated as worldling, which, as Ajahn Jayasaro points out, it sounds a bit kind of sci-fi. But the Pali term actually is putujana, jana meaning person or person basically, and putu being one of these words that can be interpreted a couple of different ways, but usually meaning many. So one of the many folk would be a literal translation, one of the many folk, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Asutava is sutta is to hear, to have heard. Okay, asutava it means one who has not heard. Okay, so an unlearnt putujana. So the word for learning is they use the word sutta, to hear. They sukampi vedanang vedayati. So notice this repetitive idiom that's so common. He feels a feeling of pleasure. He feels a feeling of pain. He feels a feeling of neither pleasure nor pain. Okay, so what's the difference? And, neither of them have actually translated this thing in full. Anyway, the response then is that the monks then should respond by saying the Blessed One is the root of our teaching. He is our resort and he is our refuge and so on, and it would be good if the Blessed One would explain it to us. So neither of the translations that we have actually have that bit in there. That's in the Pali. And the answer: when an untaught worldling is touched by a painful bodily feeling, he worries and grieves. Sochati, kilamati, paridevati, wails. Urattaling kandati, beats his breast, weeps, and is distraught. Sammohang apajati, distraught is probably quite a good, literally falls into confusion. But to be distraught, I think, is quite a good rendering of that. Remembering that, you know, in the Buddha's time, pain was much more painful than it is today. You know, these days we've got all kind of drugs and things we can have. And at least for us, you know, living in a Western country, you can have painkillers. And if you get a bit of a headache, you go and you pop a few Panadols and things like that.
Well, yeah, take something fresh and open. That went to me anyway, you see.
Whereas, of course, those things are unknown for most of the world. So that person, he thus experiences two kinds of feelings, a bodily and a mental feeling. Kai kancha, jetasi kancha, bodily and mental. Just as if a man were pierced by a dart, and following the first piercing, he was hit by a second dart. So the person will experience feelings caused by two darts. Similar with an untaught worldling, when touched by a painful feeling, he worries, grieves, and laments and experiences those two feelings. All right? Having been touched by that painful feeling, he resists it. Okay, so the word Venerable Taneshwara uses is Nyanaponika. He resists it. Oh, that would have been stressful feeling.
Yeah.
Having been touched by that painful feeling, he resists it. So this word here is Patigha.
This is that's on. What is it called? Yeah.
Resistance, yeah, the same word as in resistance, contact, yeah, like the Patika Sanya.
Yeah.
It's used both in the sense of it's literally in the sense of to hit or to ward something off, but also in a mental sense, like a sense of aversion to something, being unable to take it. Yeah. So this is that sense of big tightness and resisting around things.
What is your chant?
Sorry?
Resent
is, I'm not sure if resent is more
holding on to.
Yeah, holding on to something. It's more of a long term thing. Doesn't necessarily imply long term. But anyway, it's a similar idea. Resists or resents is a similar idea. An underlying tendency of resistance against that painful feeling comes to underlie. Okay, so again, this repetitive idiom. Okay. Anasaya and anaseti. Under the impact of that painful feeling, he then proceeds to enjoy sensual happiness. Okay, so he kama sukhang abhinandati. For what reason? Tang kisa hetu. An untaught worldling amongst does not know of any other escape from painful feelings except the enjoyment of sensual happiness. Then in him who enjoys sensual happiness, an underlying tendency to lust for sensual happiness, for sensual feelings, pleasant feelings comes to underlie his mind. He does not know according to facts. Okay, not necessarily according to facts, according to conditions would be a better translation. Yata bhutam. According to conditionality, the arising and ending of these feelings, nor the gratification, the danger, the escape connected with these feelings. So this is a very important group here of responses to things in general, but here in terms of feeling, samudayancha is the origination. Where does it come from? What's the cause of something? Atangamanancha is where does it end? Okay, how do you bring about the ending of it? What's the cessation of it? Asadancha is the sweet taste of something, the gratification, the pleasure that you get from a pleasant feeling, or whatever it is. Adinavancha is the danger, the drawbacks of it, and the nisaranancha is the escape. Okay, so to fully understanding something, so he's talking about understanding something fully. Okay, yata bhutam, understanding in terms of conditionality, understanding it fully, that has to always embody all of these things. Okay, so not just one or the other. Of course, the tendency is that often we just focus on the asada, on the gratification we get from things, and then we don't want to look at the adinava. And so sometimes when in Buddhism we look at the negative side of things, like some of these suttas we're looking at today, it's not because that's the only truth, you know, like the sutta with the divine messengers. And so he wasn't saying to him that the pleasures you enjoyed at during your life were not real. He's not saying that it wasn't actually pleasurable, but he's just saying, well, you weren't looking at the whole picture. So this is part of things which we tend to avoid looking at. Yeah, nisarana. Nisarana. Nibbana.
So the nibbana connected
with this thing. Yeah, the you know, what is it that lies beyond them? Yeah, the freedom from them.
Well, they're roots.
The contemplation of them is the root of freedom, yeah, but I think that's kind of over said. The feelings themselves is root to freedom, I think, is over reading the text. Just want to see what this is connected with the feelings. I think that's just part of the English translation. Alright. Yeah, it is. Yeah. So sarana is. Yeah. So it's used in a positive sense, like it's a place of safety and so on. But it's also the freedom from that is also used in a positive sense. Yeah. So it's one of the words where it's a dual positive. Yeah. Okay, so in him, he lacks that knowledge, an underlying tendency to ignorance as to neutral feelings comes to underlie his mind. When he experiences a pleasant feeling, a painful feeling, or a neutral feeling, he feels as one fettered by it. Such one amongst is called an untaught worldling who is fettered by birth, old age, by death, by sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. He's fettered by suffering, thus this I declare. You see, it's a bit of a... the way that the abbreviation is done is not entirely clear there. Let me just have a look through this. So he experiences the painful feeling. As a result of the painful feeling, he then delights in pleasure, looking for an escape from it, but doesn't understand pleasant feeling fully. Not understanding those things fully, he then he has the underlying tendency of ignorance underlies the neutral feeling, the neither painful nor pleasant feeling. So the text is quite accurate, actually. So this is pointing. This passage is pointing to the psychological interdependence of the three kinds of feeling. First of all, you feel pain, then you seek for pleasure as an escape for that pain. But because you don't have the equanimity around that, then you have ignorance underlies that whole process. So that the counterpart of neutral feeling is said to be. So the counterpart of pleasant feeling is said to be attraction or desire. You always want to get more pleasant feeling. The counterpart of painful feeling is rejection and repulsion. And the counterpart of neutral feeling is ignorance. Okay, because you get bored by it. So it's on neutral feeling that the pivot happens. Because with neutral feeling, if you don't have mindfulness, then it leads to ignorance. You fall asleep. Yeah, you don't pay attention. But if you have mindfulness and you bring mindfulness into that neutral feeling, then that's where wisdom and insight can arise. Okay? So, when he experiences a pleasant feeling, he feels it attached, sanyutto. Experiencing a painful feeling, he experiences it attached. Feeling a neither pleasant nor painful feeling, if he feels it attached. And this is, such a one is called an untaught worldling who's fettered by birth, old age, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. He's fettered by suffering, this I declare. But in the case of a well-taught noble disciple, amongst when he's touched by a painful feeling, he was not worry or grieve or lament, not beat his breast or weep, nor will he be distraught. One kind of feeling experiences a bodily one, but not a mental feeling. It is as if a man were pierced by a dart, but was not hit by a second dart following the first one. So this person experiences feelings caused by a single dart only. It's similar with a well-taught noble disciple. He only feels one feeling, a bodily feeling. Having been touched by that painful feeling, he does not resist it. Hence, in him, no underlying tendency of resistance against that painful feeling comes to underlie. Under the impact of that painful feeling, he does not proceed to enjoy sensual happiness, and why not? As a well-taught noble disciple, he knows of an escape from painful feelings other than by enjoying sensual pleasures. Then in him who does not proceed to enjoy sensual happiness, no underlying tendency for lust for pleasant feelings come to underlie his mind. He knows, according to facts, the rising and ending of those feelings, the gratification, danger, and escape connected with them. In him who knows thus, no underlying tendency to ignorance as to neutral feelings comes to underlie his mind. When experience a pleasant feeling, a painful feeling, or a neutral feeling, he feels it as one who is not fettered by it. He's detached. This is a well-taught, noble disciple. He is not fettered by old age, sickness, and death. He's not fettered by suffering, I declare. This is the distinction, the diversity, the difference that exists between a well-taught noble disciple and a untaught worldling. So this is the nana karanam adipaya, so nana karanam is the distinction, the difference. We say so. Okay. So this another sutta. This is a very important one. Even though we get enlightened, the one who gets enlightened will still feel pain, but their response to that is done reflectively, and because they respond to it appropriately, they don't suffer mentally because of the painful feeling.
Would it fit to mental pain that might come from the mental contact? Do you think it's someone that the disciple would experience like irritation?
This one's a bit ambiguous. Normally, you would understand that it would be an arahant who is completely free of mental suffering. Yeah, whereas the other Aryans maybe still get a bit annoyed or whatever. Certainly the stream enterer and once returner, you would imagine, would something. So it's not sure. Maybe here the it's a bit blurring those distinctions a little bit, because it says like detached, we samyutto, detached from birth, aging, and death, and so on. Usually it's only the arahant who's spoken about in those kinds of language. So maybe for the other noble ones, there might be a bit of wiggle room there.
Yeah, I mean, there's a point with the mental feeling, isn't it? Because you can have thoughts, so you can have a mental object, so how you react, so it's not just going to be just physical. So if you have thoughts, and the way you react to your thoughts can be different, so it can be mental in that sense.
Oh god, more than double. You're lucky if you keep it down to double. It's doing pretty well. Yeah, well, this is what
we're talking about.
It's focusing on this one, yeah.
But the same thing would apply, you would think, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
You can still have.
No, I mean normally it's understood that Narahant couldn't have domanasa, so they wouldn't have mental painful feelings.
Yeah, they don't. Okay.
They don't have the reaction.
Yeah, for that reason.
Does that mean that the five khandhas, one of the first khandha happens, the rest doesn't happen?
No, all the khandhas happen, but bits of the five khandhas don't happen. So for example, Sankara khandha, Sankara still happens. They can still make choices, they can still think, they can still operate perfectly well, but they can only make good choices. Yeah, so they can't make unskillful choices and these kinds of things. That's right. Like an arahant couldn't use PC, for example. I mean, that would be an interesting one to investigate.
They only can use Linux, huh?
Not
Windows, only Linux.
Well, they
don't use Mac.
Yeah, ethically.
Mac.
I don't know why the social context. Can't say that you could probably make unskillful choices, or just, again, that lack of social awareness isn't guaranteed by arahants.
Yeah.
So in that case, they could actually make people better, quite
limited. I was using unskillful there as a translation of akusala.
From a virgin, but maybe coming from a wider...
They wouldn't necessarily understand everything about the choice that they were making and all the implications of it. Yeah.
Like Sariputta. He makes statements of the Buddha and recommends him for, like, the arahant who uses his psychic powers to get the bowl.
Like Moggallana we saw yesterday wanted to turn the world upside down.
And then the Buddha said, no, don't do that. Basically. What would you do?
I was just thinking on that passage. It's like an early, interesting early version of the dangers of environmental engineering, you know, it's like the kind of cane toads or something like that. You think you're going to do something, but you don't know what the consequences of it are, you know. So I'm like, let's introduce the cane toads, they'll be really good for the sugar cane. But that's always understood to be the difference between the arahant and the Buddha, that the arahant knows for themselves what they're doing, that is from a good motivation and so on, but they can't necessarily see all of the implications that happens in the kind of the wider sphere and the longer sphere. Yeah. Absolutely not, yeah. You know.
Let's go back to pain fulfilling. So if you have a pain fulfilling in the physical body,
yeah.
And you focus your mind on the physical pain in the body,
yeah.
You can increase the physical pain.
Mm.
You can absolutely increase the physical
pain. Oh, yeah, yeah, you can magnify it, yeah.
Yeah, whereas if you distract the mind from something else, then you can completely get that.
You can, yeah. 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 Well, see, the Buddha doesn't say that's an ineffective way of coping with the pain. Yeah. It's just saying it's not as a management strategy. Then yeah, sure, you can inject some heroin and that'll make the pain go away. So as a management strategy, it can work, but it's not necessarily. But as he said, it's underlined by ignorance. But in terms of meditation practice and dealing with pain generally, I think that it's good to have basically a twofold approach, like a period of time where you focus on the pain and you just bring your mindfulness to it and be aware of it, and then when that's getting too much, then to just stop and then look at and then not look at the pain, yeah, focus on something else. And so then you have you can alternate between those two, and you can see which how much to pay attention to the pain or not pay attention to it might differ in different circumstances. You know, in some cases you may, you know, if your mind's feeling very strong, you're happy to just focus on the pain and you can just go right into it and investigate it. Other times your mind's feeble and weak and you can't do that. So both of those strategies can be useful, but it's still not underlined by ignorance, because you're not. You know that you're doing it for that reason, right? So you say there is this painful feeling and it's affecting my mind in that way, so I'm going to pay attention to something else in order to develop my mind in that way, so that's not based on ignorance.
Yeah,
yeah? It's a different thing.
That's made me think. My sister would be 2 year old,
mm-hmm.
and she'll hurt herself,
mm.
and she'll cry, oh, you know,
mm.
look at the flowers, look at the pretty flowers, mm.
yeah.
Mm. But
yeah,
suddenly there's
no, yeah,
it's good.
Mm-hmm.
So, is that the only difference between the arahant and the Buddha? That is just not seeing the wider scope?
The scope of wisdom, that's one of the major differences, yeah.
Can someone explain to me once that she said the Buddha found the path himself, the arahant,
yep.
Follow?
Yep. Yeah, that's also true, and that's very important. And that's not dissimilar, because you know, you think of that somebody, say somebody who's exploring. So when I was at school, when I was at primary school in Australia, like year after year, we spent studying the Australian explorers, right? This most kind of boring topic about some guy walking across the desert, you know, like, and then making it to the other side or not making it to the other side. That's the kind of the variation in the story. But the first one who does this, they really have to explore. They don't know. And so they have to find out everything. Where are the creeks? Is there anything in this desert? When does it rain? When does it not rain? What can you eat? What can't you eat? So they have to have a really thorough knowledge of the whole terrain, right? Somebody comes afterwards, the road's being built, you just sit in your car and zone out and just drive along the road. So this again is the difference of the Buddha, because he's already explored the whole terrain, then he has that much wider knowledge, and we just sort of sit on the freeway and... We feel like it's a drive, but it's, we might think it's hard, but relatively speaking, yeah, it's not so difficult. Okay.
In this sutta, pleasant feelings seem to be just something you use to get rid of unpleasant feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other sutras which sort of treat pleasant feelings as on a similar level to unpleasant feelings?
Oh, yeah.
Like when pleasant feelings arise, I would have thought that the sort of same
The inverse dynamic would happen, sure, yeah.
Not that you might choose to have an unpleasant feeling to get rid of the pleasant feeling, but you'd sort of...
Oh, no, it does, but it does, because if you it rises in an inverse way, you know, somebody's taking away my pleasant feeling, so then you get angry with them,
yeah.
You know, but so
also
it's jealousy
the
and
pleasant, the, that idea of you have a pleasant feeling and it just continues, and it actually becomes an unpleasant feeling,
right.
Because, you just...
So there's of course it's treated in different ways in different suttas, it's just one example. Alright, so again I'll skip over a few of the suttas here in Bhikkhu Bodhi's book and come to next one here, Anguttara 2.6. So, Anguttara here. Right. So back to Anguttara 4.6. 2.4. The numbers given here. 2.4.6. Samachitta. Is that right? Not quite sure if this is correct or not. Here's the corresponding suttas. It's got Spanish translation, Spanish, German, and English one. This one. That's good. Mostly people in Australia, the Malaysians did some. So this one's quite a short little sutta, but has an interesting take on things. One time Venerable Mahakachayana was staying in Benares on the bank of the river Kadama Daha. Is that right? I'm in Aranda. Different places here. Anyway, I think there's two different places. What is then the Brahman Aramadanda? It's misspelled here. It's Aramadanda. He could be the approached Mahakachayana and said to him, "Why? What is the reason? What is the cause why warriors dispute with warriors, Brahmins with Brahmins, householders with householders, and even recluses with recluses?" Okay. And this is a very interesting question for our world today. Why do people always fighting with each other? on account of conceited, bonded attachment to sensual craving, warriors dispute with warriors, Brahmins with Brahmins, and householders with householders. So for lay people in the world, typically disputes is the sensual desire, and he uses quite a long word here for the to describe the sensual desire, the Pali compound here.
Oh, doesn't
quite fit on the screen. Keep on just pulling that out a little bit and see how far we get. Oh, no, still got a bit more to go. Gosh. Oh, yeah, about that. Now we have got to chant this one. Yeah.
There's two long words.
Okay. Karma. Yeah, it's the same thing. Karma raga. Karma is the sensual desire. Raga is lust, the desire. Abhinivesa is insistence. So it's this word, insistence. Only this is true, everything else is false. Vinibandha. Bandha is a bond, literally a bond, same as the English word bond. So vinibandha is an intense bond or strong bond. Pali gedha is gedha again is just a word for desire, so pali gedha is an intensive form of that. Pariyupana is a sense of being overwhelmed or intoxicated. Ajahosana is a hold, a tight holding. So these are all basically words for desire in Pali, which is kind of these kinds of compounds. Sometimes, I mean, obviously you've got a cumulative effect of all of these words. Yeah, I mean, he could have just said attachment. Yeah, right. But he's got this whole kind of thing. It sort of pounds up. It's a pretty.
When we translate it into English, it sounds like
just
the whole.
Yeah. Kinda. This one, because it's so complex, you wouldn't kind of react to it so, you know, intuitively. You have to sort of figure it out a bit. Yeah. So that's that. So this is why lay people argue, and the main point of this one is, why do samanas argue with samanas? So why do ascetics or religious people argue with each other? Because of attachment to views. Dipti raga vinivesa vinibanda paligeda pariyotano tanjohosana hetu. Okay? So for lay people it's karma, and for monastics dipti. That's why we argue with each other.
Views about
so obviously a bit of insight going on there.
Yeah, views about the
kitchen, views about how she was set up. Well, interestingly enough, in one of the grammars, Sanskrit grammars, it's giving an example of different kinds of dwanda compound. And there's many. You heard dwanda compound is two elements, and they're listed one after the other, so that they can be in various relationships to each other. And the grammar sort of describes one kind of dwanda compound where the two elements are listed after each other, and they're in constant conflict with each other. And the example he gives for that is samana brahmana, the ascetics and the priests. Yeah? So that's two things which are compounded together and always in constant conflict. So that's that little sutta there. And so he, this is just the sutta goes on, and he asks, is there anyone who's overcome these attachments? And he says, it's Kachayana responds, yes, in Sabati there's the Buddha who's living, and he's overcome these things. And so the Brahman then gains great faith in the Buddha because of that. So these suttas here that Bhikkhu Bodhi's given about who lives in, why is there hate and why is there violence? And there's quite a number of suttas actually that deal with that question. One of the most powerful ones is the sutta the In the Atikavaga of the Sutta Nipata, the Kalahavivada Sutta is quite an extraordinary probably the most extraordinary of the verse suttas. But down here, just giving some of the examples, and typically the Buddha point to our desires and attachments as being the cause of conflict, and of course we can see that so obviously in our world today, where people are going to war on the drop of a hat. The drop of the habit, just about to, and it's all about desire, you know, about wanting wealth, wanting resources, wanting control, all of these kinds of things. And this is what's fueling the anger and the hatred in the world. Okay, so what thing that the Buddha did, as well as pointing to the importance of desire as such, as a simple force in human psychology, he also pointed to the way that that this was entwined more profoundly with the nature of our thinking and the nature of our the way our conscious processes unfold themselves in general. So, for example, we have a sutta talking to Saka, the king of the Devas, and he asks, beings wish to live without hate, harming, hostility or enmity, and yet they live in hate, harming each other, hostile and as enemies. Why? What fetters are they bound with that they live in such a way? And the Buddha replies, it's because they have the fetters of envy and niggardliness. That's why they wish to live in peace, but they actually live in war. And then Saka says, well, what gives rise to envy and niggardliness? And he says, the Buddha replies, they arise from liking and disliking. Okay? Two preferences. Preferences arise from desire. Desire arises from thinking. When the mind thinks about something, desire arises. When the mind thinks about of nothing, desire does not arise. Thinking, what gives rise to thinking? Thinking, world of the Devas, arises from elaborated perceptions and notions. So it's Papancha Sanya Sankhara. When elaborated perceptions and notions are present, thinking arises. When they're absent, thinking does not arise. Okay, so here is pointing to whereas in the one we looked at beforehand, on a sort of simple level, there's sort of a distinction between the desire and the views, right? So on one hand, that's sort of relatively valid, but he's also here pointing to the connection between them. It's the very fact that we have views about things, we tend to think about them, and then this gives rise to our attachment to things. And it's interesting when you that comes out very very clearly in people's relationship to food. You know, you see, like when you come to a monastery, you could have challenged in food. Kind of, you have the two tendencies. You have the desire type, and then it's kind of what you want is the food that tastes good, and then you have the view type, and then you want to have the food which is nutritious, which is kind of organic and doesn't have any additives and is GM free and all of those kinds of things. And often that can be harder to deal with in a monastic setting, to deal with the attachment to the ideas about your food, more so than the taste of them.
What if you rather just not eat?
Would you rather not just not eat? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Prognosis is not good. Yeah.
Become a breatharian.
Yeah, you could do that, become a breatharian. Siddhanta told me about some breatharians. He knew these people were breatharians, but they used to eat McDonald's from time to time, but they said they were just conforming with the ways of the world. They actually still breatharians. Sorry.
When
the
Buddha actually
explains
things like this, it looks like cause and effect.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, interesting. That's quite a profound question, because there's a question of the objectivity of truth. If anybody investigated in the same way, would they come to the same result? Difficult to say. Yeah. Difficult to say. I mean, the reality is that lots of people do investigate these things, and that they do in fact come to lots of different results. Right, so if you wanted to answer that basic question, why is there conflict in the world today, when you can find 1,000 theorists and columnists and opinion columns, they're all giving you a different answer.
Yeah.
Again, a bit of a controversial area. Certainly in the early texts and in the Pali, then they're always presented as being very harmonious. So the views of the arahats are always very harmonious with the views of the Buddha. And of course, that's nice. When we look at the claims made by arahants today, as Aya said, that you know, statements made by some arahants in Sri Lanka or arahants or people perceived as being or claiming to be arahants in Sri Lanka or Thailand or whatever, sometimes they say things which seem to disagree with the suttas. And say someone like Ajahn Mahabhu is quite open about that. He says, "Oh yeah, the suttas are wrong. You know, they must have missed something out or lost something or whatever, that they don't talk about this." You know, he's not trying to argue that it is in fact in agreement with the suttas. He realizes that it's not, and says that the suttas must therefore be wrong. Yeah.
And they have to face opposition, face a lot of opposition.
Sure.
But they want to be abused. And
well, exactly, and that's not what it's saying. Yeah, and so it's not saying, you know, don't have views and don't defend them and so on. But there's a difference between a reasoned discussion of views and an ability to have differences in points of view, and then just a sort of dogmatic defending of it. It's kind of put quite nicely at the beginning of the Milinda Panha, when King Milinda comes to Nagasena, the monk, and says, "Oh, I'd like to have some discussion about Dhamma." And he says, "Well," Nagasena says, "Well, are we going to discuss like kings, or are we going to discuss like philosophers?" And he says, "Well, how do the kings discuss?" And he says, "Well, kings discuss, they see if they agree with each other. If they don't agree, then they'll have a fight and one of them will chop the head off the other." And how do philosophers discuss? "Well, they discuss and see what the reason is for the views, and then if they need to change their views, they change it for the reason." He says, "Okay, well, let's discuss as philosophers then." Yeah. So this is the thing. And often the problem with those kind of very intractable debates, you know, like political debates and so on, is that you have a constant many issues involved, but one thing is you have a constant need to address surface issues. So say in the sphere of politics, it's always like, well, is this particular policy a good idea? Should we spend money on this or on that? But of course, underlying your preferences is a whole system of value judgments which are not addressed within that political system. And so there's deeply held ideological and value systems which are just informing that debate, and until they're addressed, you're never going to find agreement. Yeah. Okay, so just read one more sutta. So today we've looked at the question of aging and death, the fact that we're inevitably subject to these things. We've looked at the fact that during life we're going to be experiencing pain and suffering, and that we have a choice in how to deal with that. And we've looked at the fact that we live in a world in conflict, and that because of our need and competition for resources and so on, that we always end up in conflict with each other, being another source of suffering. But at the end of the day, the great source of suffering and the great understanding of suffering in Buddhism comes from the notion of samsara. And so we've got some very powerful suttas on samsara at the end here. So I'll just read through a few of these. The Blessed One said this: "Monks, this samsara is without discoverable beginning." So this is a very important point. Without discoverable beginning, anamatago ko ayang samsaro.
Understandable.
Yeah. And this is So this phrase is found all the way through this particular section. Anamataggo ko ayang kiwe sansaro. Okay, this particular phrase, anamatagga, is grammatically a bit obscure and not entirely clear, but the meaning of it seems to be the agga is the point, and the amata is the unthought or unknown in this case. But the meaning of it is more clear in the second phrase here, where it says a first point is not discerned. Pubakoti napanyayati. Yeah. Okay. So this is very important. A first point is not discerned. Pubakoti, beginning koti is a point. It's not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by cravings. Okay, roaming and wandering on, sandhavatam, sansaratam. So the wandering on here is the same word as the word we have, sansara. Okay, sansaratam, roaming on, the wandering on. Suppose like some man would cut up whatever grass, sticks and foliage there are in this Jambudvipa, the whole Indian subcontinent, and collect them together into a single heap. Having done so, he would put them down, saying for each one, this is my mother, this is my mother's mother. The sequence of that man's mothers and grandmothers would not come to an end, and yet the grass, sticks, branches and foliage in this Jambudvipa would be used up and exhausted. For what reason, monks? Because this samsara is without discoverable beginning. A first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. For such a long time, monks, you have experienced suffering, anguish and disaster and swelled the cemetery. It's enough to become disenchanted with all sankharas, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to become liberated from them. Okay, so this particular part of the Samyutta Nikaya then has a whole series of similes about the size of sankhara. Somebody, monk comes and says to the Buddha, how long is an eon? A kalpa. And the Buddha says, an eon is long, monk. It's not easy to count it and say it's so many years or so many hundreds of years or so many thousands of years or so many hundreds of thousands of years. Then is it possible to give a simile, Venerable Sir? And the Buddha says, yes, it is. Suppose, monk, there was a great stone mountain, a yojana long, a yojana wide, that's about 20 kilometers or so, and a yojana high, with holes, without holes or crevices, one solid mass of rock. Right. At the end of every 100 years, a man would stroke it once with a piece of delicate cloth. That great stone mountain might by this effort be worn away and eliminated, but the eon would still not have come to an end. That is how long an eon is. And of eons of such a length, we wandered through many of them, many hundreds, many thousands, many hundreds of thousands of eons of such a length. And so this is a very powerful imagery of how of the length of time in samsara. So quite extraordinary how the Buddha's conception of time is congruent, certainly with our modern understanding of how long a universe will last. That idea of the great length of time is originated in the Mesopotamian region, and is originally as a result of the kind of the multiplications that happen when you start to try to reconcile the cycles of the stars and the planets and so on. So when the years and the seasons have cycles, but of course everything shifts a little bit and nothing quite adds up. And so if you take the cycles of the moon and try to correlate them, and then the shifts of the planets and so on, and you try to work them out, what they tried to do is to say, well, was there a first point? Because they assumed that everything would have been perfect in the beginning. and that it would kind of unfold and gradually drift apart. So you sort of try to wind it back and say, where would the point where everything would line up and be perfect? And so once you start to do that, you have to multiply all these systems together, and you very quickly get into extremely large numbers. And so that's how mathematically the use of these very large numbers first arose in Mesopotamia and those regions, and then moved to India, and contrasts quite strongly with very short periods of time to the West, where in Judaic mythology and Greek mythology, you have only a few, it's very, very short span of time, only a few centuries. In the whole of Greek mythology only spans, you know, a few generations, really. You know, just a few hundred years. There's not this idea of these great periods of time. Okay, so just read one more simile on that. Monks, there comes a time when the great ocean dries up and evaporates and no longer exists, but still I say there is no making an end of suffering for those beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. Okay, so this avijja nivaranam satanam tanha samyojananam. Hindered by ignorance, beings fettered by craving. There comes a time, monks, when Sineru, the king of mountains, burns up and perishes, but still there is no making an end of suffering for those wandering and on through samsara. There comes a time, monks, when the great earth burns up and perishes, but still there is no making an end of suffering for those beings wandering on in samsara. Suppose, monks, a dog tied up to a leash was bound to a strong post or pillar. It would just keep on running and revolving around that same post or pillar. So too, the uninstructed worldling regards form as self, feeling as self, perception as self, sankharas as self, consciousness as self. He just keeps running and revolving around form, around feeling, around perception, around sankharas, around consciousness. As he keeps on running and revolving around them, he's not freed from form, not freed from suffering, not freed from perception, not freed from volitional formations, and not freed from consciousness. He is not freed from birth, aging and death, not freed from sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection and despair, not freed from suffering, I say. So that's the cheery for today. The next chapter is called The Bringer of Light. Okay, so hopefully moving into a more positive mode, but it's very important to keep reminding ourselves of that, and especially in the holy life and the monastic life, that sometimes, you know, you are experiencing suffering. Sometimes things get too much, they do get overwhelming, and just to keep on reminding yourself that what we're experiencing now is only a tiny fragment of what reality is, and the reality of our life in samsara is so much greater than we can imagine. Yeah, sure. Sure. Yeah.
Is that possible? Because, something like stream enter is something like once you get there, it's almost like you have to reach enlightenment.
Mm.
Like it or not,
you just have to deal with it, yeah. keep a bit of ignorance in your back pocket so that you can help people. Is it possible?
Yeah.
You're asking me a question about the nature of reality or about what the texts say?
Both.
Well, what the texts say is fairly easy. That idea doesn't appear in the Pali Canon at all. And the idea of rebirth is rebirth happens because you're ignorant and because you're craving. If you're not ignorant, then doesn't lead to rebirth, but that's also what leads to suffering. Yeah, so getting rid of ignorance never leads to happiness. So the idea that you can keep your ignorance in order to relieve the suffering of others is completely against the whole tenor of the early suttas. And of course that's something which emerged in the Mahayana canon. Okay, but one thing about when understanding Mahayana philosophy is that for every development which you have in there, there's always a counter development. So there's always a philosophical perspective on it, which in a sense sort of balances or undermines the original proposition. Okay, so in a sense, in this case, you say, well, I'm going to keep my ignorance so I can remain in samsara, right? But you also say at the same time that samsara is only what exists in my mind. Okay, so it goes together with this idealist philosophy that I'm going to save all beings, but actually all beings are just projection of what's happening in my mind already. So if you look at the way that the philosophers reconcile these things, they're always counteracting them with these two perspectives. Sorry? If enlightenment varies by culture. If you believe that view, can you become an arahant?
No,
is that a question?
Oh,
it's just Indian enlightenment.
It's not Korean enlightenment.
So you've got chapati enlightenment and then spring roll enlightenment. Falafel enlightenment. But from a Mahayana perspective, isn't it actually nothing?
What is nothing?
Well, the fact that all of those things are found in the culture and so on, it's just as much nothing as anything else. This is the point I was getting at before, that these things are always counteracted. Or like another way of putting it is like you say, I'm going to renounce Nibbana so I can stay in samsara, right? But at the same time, then they'll say, well, Nibbana and samsara are really the same. Yeah? So what are you renouncing and what are you keeping?
Well,
yeah?
Look,
I think it's very complicated. What I think would be better for now, that's getting into some fairly deep philosophical waters, and we'll have a look at some of those things maybe in some more detail when we do the history class, and we'll discuss like how the Buddhist teaching sort of evolved and changed throughout the years. One reason being for that is because the way that the views are expressed and the ideas come about always is embedded in a culture, and so we need to understand what did it mean for those people in that time. So for now, the main focus is just to try to get an idea what are the suttas actually pointing to and what are they saying, and you know the kind of the teaching that we're finding here is, I think, is very very clear and very internally consistent. We already saw before that the teaching on Yama, the god of the dead, that he was pointing to the fact that you are responsible for your own choices and your own actions, and so that happens on an ethical level, yeah, on an everyday level. But according to Buddhism, it also happens on a transcendent level, yeah, and on the big scale of things as well. Yeah. And so, in a sense, with that, the Mahayana, if you take a very literalist interpretation of the Mahayana doctrine and say, well, it literally means you're going to stay here in samsara, so you can help all beings, but of course there's this internal contradiction about it, because you're not acting in the way that you're teaching. Yeah, you're telling everybody else, get out of samsara, but I'm going to stay here. And so there's an internal, for me, the most powerful kind of teacher is a teacher who's always telling you to do, who's setting the example. Yeah? And so that's not just a theoretical thing, it's a very practical thing. That's what the Buddha did. He set the example, and his religion is still having that effect for so many people after all these years. Yeah? And so that's proved to be a very resilient and a very inspiring idea for many billions of people. Yeah, and you know, another example, just a modern day example, say Ajahn Chah, when he died, there's like 250,000 people came to his funeral. So it's not as if his practice was just him alone and he wasn't caring about anybody else. Yeah? The reality was that affected, very profoundly affected many, many people.
Yeah, I don't really question the outcome of the practice.
Sure.
In itself, but I don't really think that we can actually discuss it. In any sort of way, we've never known of the origin of the idea of in a different culture, context, really.
I don't know, are they? I don't know. Could be. Hard to say. And always to put that into perspective, you know, that for most of us the reality is that it's fairly obvious when we have greed, hatred and delusion, and that it's not in fact for the benefit of others.
So
we know what to do with this greed, hatred and delusion. Theoretical idea, is it possible to have some greed, hatred and delusion that might be useful for others, is for most of us fairly far apart from our reality.
Well, that's the argument that you use to say that, how the arahants are selfish, to counteract that argument that, the three different things. Is it for the benefit for myself? Is it for the benefit of others? Is it for the benefit of both?
For the benefit of both, yeah.
Yeah.
We should finish up. We'll discuss this more later on. Yeah, so we're getting a bit late. So We're going to be having a meeting at 7 o'clock. We're getting a bit on. Let's have a meeting at 7:30, so we don't have to rush too much.
This is okay.
Where the Sutta, the name of the Sutta, you mentioned that the light will go attached to your Kamaraga and your now to go attached to the Ditti.
It's in here.
It's on the town.
You can know, you can find the reference here. Buddha Nikaya, 2.4.6.